Hi, I'm Chandana Rao.
And I'm Meera. We are associated members of ML4Q.
And you're listening to ML4 Q&A, a show where members from the Matter and Light for Quantum Computing Cluster talk about their careers, their research, and the future of quantum.
Today, we're excited to welcome one of ML4Q's members, Dr. Lars Schreiber, a lecturer at RWTH Aachen University and a senior researcher in the Quantum Technology Group, together with his students Mats Vollmer and Max Beer.
Dr. Schreiber leads the effort on silicon-based spin qubit devices and is also the coordinator of the European consortium SIQBus, which aims to realize a quantum bus, a key building block for the true scalability of silicon quantum computer architectures.
It's a question many of us ask: if semiconductor technology is already so advanced, why don't we yet have a million qubit quantum computer based on semiconductor spins? In this episode, we explore exactly that.
We discuss the major challenges in scaling semiconductor spin qubit architectures today and hear directly from Mats and Max as they dive into the technical details of their impressive work on spin qubit shuttling and T-junctions, which is an approach that is becoming increasingly important across different quantum computing platforms as a route toward scalable architectures.
Welcome to all three guests today. We have Dr. Lars Schreiber leading the effort on silicon-based qubit devices with his two PhD students, Mats Vollmer and Max Beer. I'm particularly excited for this episode because I have worked on the theory side of spin qubits, and I also know Mats and Max for some time now. So let's start with the career journeys. So Lars, your diploma thesis, which was done at RWTH, was on spin coherence and spin dephasing of hot electron spins in 3-5 semiconductors. And then your master thesis was done at the University of Cambridge on the growth of aluminium gallium arsenide heterostructures using molecular beam epitaxy. Unfortunately, I couldn't find them online, but I see that they are already going in the direction of spin qubit architectures. This was also after the seminal paper by Daniel Loss and David DiVincenzo on spin qubits. So did that influence your choice of topics in any way?
No, at that time I wasn't aware of this. So I was mainly interested in semiconductors from lectures, four diploma lectures in Aachen. And that made then my choice to go to Cambridge and there to look into growth, which was basically a random decision. So I learned about molecular beam epitaxy and high quality growth of 3-5 semiconductors, and that also was an important step to know how tricky it is to grow these heterostructures and to learn the language that I can now use to communicate with the growers. We cooperate with many excellent groups that grow us the heterostructures, and then we can communicate about these issues. And the quality of the heterostructures is extremely important for the quantum computing now. So this helps a lot.
And then in your PhD thesis, you were already looking into information processing using spins. So were you at this time introduced to quantum computing already? And these were also the 3-5 semiconductors. Would you say that the methods you used back then are similar to the methods that your students use today? How has your PhD shaped your research today?
So that was very different. It was a femtosecond spectroscopy working so with optics, with lasers, a quite complex experiment. And I've learned that these optical experiments are very delicate and hard to handle. I was then later very happy that I could go to transport experiments, which are more stable. So I remember many days there where I tuned the mirrors over the day and then measured during the night. So pretty hard work. But what the topic was about indeed semiconductors. I kept this topic about the material that I've learned in Cambridge. and then added this spin aspect to it, so spintronics. And mm-hmm. there it was about the transport. And that influenced also the main topic that we are doing now, transporting spin qubits. But at that time, it was not a single spin, but many, many, many spins. And it was not really quantum. Everything was defined by magnetization, classical magnetization vectors. Very interesting topic. And at the moment, spintronics also leads to something. But at that time, was a bit unsatisfactory because I wanted to do something more quantum. Mm-hmm. And then I came across a colloquium talk by Lieven van der Sijpen in Aachen. And he showed that one can control single electrons and read this out. And that was then the point that I wanted to go to TU Delft.
So now that we got to know how Lars' journey was as a PhD student, so in this podcast, one special thing we have is we also have his PhD students, that is Max and Mats. So can you both tell us how is your PhD and what attracted you to work under this topic that you're currently working on?
Yeah, so I actually started my bachelor's thesis in a somewhat different topic, theory of topological insulators. And then over the time, just got to know that I'm a person, I need to do stuff with my own hands. I need to see the physics directly myself. And so I was naturally drawn towards the experiment more and more. And then I still wanted to stay in a field that is quantum computing adjacent. And there is the, back then and still today, this very strong spin qubit group here in Aachen and... I joined for my master's thesis and never looked back.
So Max, how was your journey?
Yeah, for me it was, I would say, even less exciting. So first, I've been here at RWTH for the entire time, same as Mats. But I've also been doing my bachelor thesis in the same group as I'm doing my PhD now, as well as my master thesis. I started out my bachelor thesis working on cryo amplifiers, so heterojunction bipolar transistors, cooled and down in liquid helium. A lot of dipstick testing, dipping the samples in liquid helium and just checking the characteristics. And then I kind of moved on from that in my master's. I also did the quantum information specialization that was quite new. I think that was the second year that I joined in that. There I really wanted to go into semiconductor fabrication. So I elected my courses properly to do the theoretical basis here at the Electrical Engineering Institute. And then I also did the lab course. Actually, I did two lab courses. One of that was voluntary. That was the fabrication lab course at the Electrical Engineering Department, where you could actually go into the clean room together with the professor in a small group. That was quite fun. The devices obviously didn't work, as they usually do for the first fabrication that you do. Then I moved on to my master thesis, where I then fabricated the Huber samples that my then master supervisor, and I measured also and fortunately got a publication out of afterwards, which, so somewhat productive. And then essentially I just continued onwards in my PhD, fabricated my T-junction devices, obviously much larger, and I've been working on the measurement and the publication of this data now.
How's it doing a PhD as an experimentalist? Do you have to wait very long for results? I remember when we were in Davos and we were just hanging out in Matt's room one evening, and then he was still running these experiments in the background.
Yeah, I guess there can be times where you, in principle, just wait for good data to pile in. It all depends on the sample, at least at the moment where, still somewhat... a more academic style of fabrication, which is very flexible. Just some samples work better than others. And sometimes you measure a sample and you notice that a gate might not work, and then you have to warm it up again and start over. And I guess that's just part of the process. But when you get one sample that works, you can make a lot of progress in a very short amount of time. And I think back in Davos, that was actually quite an intense time where I measured quite a lot of data. I actually I guess the majority of the data that I so far have recorded during my PhD within the total duration of 3 months. So yeah, it was quite important to keep the experiment running and alive. And so I was working somewhat around the clock during these 3 months, but yeah, quite happy that I did that. And looking forward to the next sample that hopefully will work soon.
Yeah, I remember you said that you were running these experiments overnight or something.
Yeah. I mean, in principle, they can, like a certain experiment can run for quite a while alone by itself. Sometimes they drift out of the sensitive. So, for instance, your charge sensor can drift out of its sensitive region, or your spin-to-charge conversion for spin readout. That can also drift out of the sensitive region. So you have to regularly check whether everything's still going on fine. And also sometimes you just want to change experiment parameters because you're happy with your earlier measurements. So there needs to be some interaction, but sometimes you can also just let it run overnight. And well, actually, regularly we just let it run overnight just to see whether something occurred during the night.
So... then after your PhD, Lars, you did a postdoc at Delft in the group of van der Sippen, another popular name in the spin-qubit community. And then you came back to Aachen, where you have been teaching since 2018, I think. And I had the opportunity to attend your course 2 years ago on the theory behind spin-qubit experiments. It really helped me develop a solid understanding of the device and how things work in practice. And for me, it served as a valuable bridge between theory and the real world. How challenging was it for you to design such a course?
So first of all, it's great that it helped you. Actually, I started lecturing right away. So I was, I think, announced in a lecturer, AVTR lecturer in 2018, but... during my whole career, I helped with lectures, exercises, and also when I came here to Aachen, which was already some time ago, end of 2011, I started and designing this one was not so difficult because it is my specialized knowledge. So designing the fundamental lectures is more tricky. It's of course then a lot of fun because it is my main interest, and we could brought many experiments in them in this course, and we could learn about the state of the art experiments. I'm also teaching a Python programming course since 2015 every year, and that was an interesting challenge because it was something that we just noticed that the AVTR students have a very different background knowledge in programming, and then we had this as a optional course in the beginning, in the evening, with some gamification so that people had fun to come to this course. And then later it was included into the main curriculum, and now it's a course that all the bachelor students in physics have to attend since 3 years now. So that is also a course that I designed over years, and there's also stuff like lab courses and seminars.
Yeah, I think programming is quite important for a physicist, whether you do experimental physics or theory. Also, do you think this lecture that you did on spin qubits can also be taught at bachelor's level, can be introduced to students earlier?
Well, that needs to be digested in a way. There are other lectures that we have at RWTH Aachen. So we have a master specialization branch in quantum technology, and that starts then with a platform course that gives an overview over the different qubit platforms. And probably this one is more suitable to start with. And then people, if they like the spin qubits, then they can go deeper into that topic. Of course, one can also then on spin qubits teach to bachelor students the important points, because it's not all about deep quantum technology. There are so many things that go together, electronics, programming, and it's nice that students from the beginning see that how many bricks enter into such a field.
Yes. Let's now talk a little about your research.
So Lars, you've been extensively working on the silicon-based spin qubits. So to set the stage for our listeners, could you explain in simple terms what a spin qubit is?
Yes, yes. So actually, I started with gallium arsenide spin qubits in Delft. That was the established system at that time. And then I moved, one of the first ones who moved to silicon in 2010. So, but first of all, what is it about? So for qubits, we need a two-level quantum system. And the electron spin, or also Hall spin, but let's say electron spin because this is what I'm mainly dealing about. Is there a natural system because it has only spin up and spin down state? And the energy of these states are different when we apply a magnetic field. Therefore, we get already a nice qubit. And now we need to capture this electron so that we do not lose this qubit. And this can be done nicely in such a semiconductor like silicon or a silicon germanium heterostructure that already provides one confinement direction. And then one has various options to provide the other confinement directions. And our preferred way is to have a couple of gates on top of the device that then sets the barriers in the other directions. And in this way, we form a quantum dot where we then capture a single electron. There are other options. One can use wires, quantum wires, or one can use donors, some crystal defects that can bound the electron or a hole. And in the end, it is a matter of scalability, what systems can be scaled the most, the easiest. So first of all, now we trap our electron in this quantum dot, and then we use its spin as a qubit, and there are ways to manipulate it by electron spin resonance or some variants of that. One can read out with certain scheme the spin and transfer it into, for example, a current that can be measured. There are ways to couple two spins together. So one has then the full set of qubit operations defined by the DiVincenzo criteria.
But what motivated you to shift to silicon?
Hmm. Yes. So to be honest, it was at that time an idea that... a project that Lieven van der Seypen had. So first of all, I started with gallium arsenide. And also, gallium arsenide is my whole history that I worked with indium gallium arsenide system. So I was very familiar with the 3-5 system. I know it's a very good heterostructure because the lattice constant of gallium arsenide and aluminium gallium arsenide is the same. One can nicely grow them on top of each other. But then we also realized in the first experiments, the nuclear spins are something annoying. So we did, for example, manipulation experiments where we have a certain frequency, and this frequency has to match the energy difference of the up and the down state that is given by a magnetic field. But then one has also some random magnetic fields, and one of these is this nuclear spin bar that gives a so-called Overhauser field that is not fully controlled. And in gallium arsenide, this is an unavoidable thing because all the arsenic and gallium atoms always have a nuclear spin. That's related to the fact that there are 3 and 5 material, so they always have an odd number of protons, and that means then that they have a nuclear spin, cannot be compensated by the number of neutrons in the nucleus. And so one has to kind of live with that. And then at that time, there were different ways. For example, a person called Hendrik Bloom tried to stabilize the nuclear spin bath. And other people considered, for example, to go to holes, which couple less to the nuclear spins. And I thought, well, then it might be a good idea to go to a material system which has no nuclear spins. And this, in principle, can be silicon At that time, it was not isotopically purified, but had some silicon 29 nuclei, which has then a small a hyperfine interaction, a small Overhauser field that acts on the nuclear spins. But it gives us immediately a better coherence time. It's easier to manipulate. But in the beginning, it was very painful because it also meant that the heterostructure is not so perfect and that one has more charge noise, and to just trap the electrons, where it was very hard. Also, it has a larger effective electron mass, which means that the fabrication of these devices is much more difficult compared to gallium arsenide. The gate structures that we put on top have to be done. Yeah, the feature size is smaller. And that was just at the edge of what can be academically be fabricated. And it took then some time that the results also from other groups came. And then there was later a complete transition of all the groups towards silicon systems, either silicon or silicon germanium.
So we see that already spin qubits are not really confined to one type of material. You can use different materials and have these trapped electrons. Are there also different types of qubits?
Mm-hmm. Yes, so there are various materials, indeed silicon, gallium arsenide. We are also working on zinc selenide, a 2-6 system. And there's also germanium, silicon germanium. But there are also indeed different types. So the ones that is obvious is to use one electron, which has a spin up and spin down. One can also use in a material a hole, so it's simply not a charge that is in the conduction band of the material, but in the valence band. Which has then simply other properties in terms of, for example, properties like spin-orbit interaction, or has then also a different effective mass that influences the device. And then there's also encoding. So one can use not just one electron, but for example, two electrons to define a qubit. First of all, then one has four states, but one can pick then two states out of the Hilbert space get some advantages, for example, to be robust against some variation global magnetic field. This is, for example, the single triplet qubit. Another one is the exchange-only qubit that then consists of three electrons that have to be set in three quantum dots that are tunnel-coupled next to each other. The advantage is then that one can use other methods for manipulation, not just ESR and EDSR, but just the exchange coupling, the tunnel coupling between these qubits for manipulation. But that comes from with the costs that it's a more complex system. So in total, many of these encodings materials work very well when you look at a single device with one or two qubits. The big question now is which of these approaches, material and encoding, works best for scaling up the system. And the goal is to go to millions of qubits. This is what we need then for to having really quantum advantage with a quantum computer.
Now that you mentioned that you want to focus towards the quantum advantage and towards scaling of these quantum computers, so qubits cannot be confined to just one place, and that doesn't help us in scaling these quantum computers. So how are you kind of addressing these questions of, you know, transporting these qubits across the chip, let's say?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I start a little bit before to understand why we want to transport. So the first thing that is really nice about our qubits is that they are extremely small. So they are the smallest among all the other qubit platforms. 30 nanometer in diameter, for example. So a little bit larger in gallium arsenide than silicon, but doesn't matter, because in the end, when we fabricate by industry a chip, it will have a size of 10 by 10 millimeters or 20 by 20 millimeters. And when you just calculate how much space that is, we can put billions of qubits on this chip. Okay, so why are we not there yet? The problem is that our qubit lives in a material, not like in vacuum, like ion traps or neutral atoms, and they are influenced by material imperfections. And these imperfections have to be balanced out by tuning voltages. And every qubit basically needs its own little trap with tuned up special voltages for this qubit, for this place. And in the end, we need then, for all these qubits, one can calculate that, two defined voltages. One for its chemical potential, one two for its barrier to its neighbor, as an example. So in the end, we need millions of voltages fine-tuned if you would just follow scaling up the single two-qubit demonstrator chips that we have now. And this is simply not possible. So a chip cannot have millions of terminals. We don't want to have millions of wires going up to room temperature electronics. So the key point to now scale this up is to make a compromise, not having these little dots so close to each other, but making them a little bit sparser, having have a sparse 2D matrix. And this extra space that we get then could be sufficient to implement cryo-electronics that generates the signals that we need. So, and we need very specific signals then for the points where we do manipulation, because this is a delicate thing. So we need a manipulation zone, a readout zone. There we have to tune up the voltages very, very precisely. And for that, we need then this on-chip electronics and individual tuning up of different regions. And the electronics has to be, we just call this tiled up with the quantum layer. So we have a certain tile in the quantum layer, on top a tile of electronics. And when the footprint of these two tiles match, then one can tile it up and have a large chip. And the balance that we see is now to have a tile which has a size of 10 by 10 micrometer. So it's not a 10 nanometer qubit anymore, but 10 by 10 micrometer. And there, in such a tile, we can put in the electronics and also a couple of qubits. So then we can scale this up. But we also now have to make it possible that the qubits can communicate with each other, because they can only do two qubit gates when they are very close to each other. They need to have tunnel coupling. And for that, we need to somehow, for example, transport them from one to the other so that they can do two qubit gates. And then that only can work if one finds a transport mechanism which is from the signals that easy that it can be also implemented on this cryo-electronic tiles. So we were seeking for a very simple method to transport the qubits. And there we also had to make compromises. We couldn't do individual tuning anymore, but we could only use a few signals. In the best case, the number of signals required for transporting should be independent of the transport length. And that was then the idea for our transport method. We generate with only four simple signals, kind of a wave that transport the electrons within this wave from one side to the other. It's a rough method. The qubits have to survive that. The qubit information has to survive it. It's rough because all the potential disorder that we have, all the stones, we just go over that with this wave. And the wave has to be large enough that this is possible. And then we bring it to the next manipulation zone. And this manipulation zone, we are then very careful in tuning up the voltages again and so on. So this was the key challenge. It's not only this transporting that we want to have that, but it must be easy in terms of the signals that we need and therefore be implementable in a cryo-electronic tiles.
And then this propagating wave that you mentioned is also known as the conveyor belt or conveyor mode shuttling, I think. There's also a bucket brigade shuttling. Can you tell us a little about that? And also, why do you prefer doing the conveyor mode shuttling?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So... So first of all, people have a series of quantum dots in a device which are tunnel coupled. And then the first idea one could have is to transport an electron by letting it hop from one dot to the next. And this is called bucket brigade. So a bucket here is this quantum dot. And then we calculated that this is only possible if the tunnel couplings are fine-tuned. And that requires for each tunnel coupling a tuned up voltage. And when we want to go a distance of 10 micrometer, which we know is required for implementing the cryoelectronics, then one need to go hop about 200, or let's say 100 quantum dots. And that needs then this to transport in this way, one require a lot of fine-tuned voltages. And this is exactly what we want to avoid. And there were also efforts in that. I had a very nice project, a Quantera project, that started in 2017 together with TU Delft. And they tried to, the Bucket Brigade, put a lot of effort into fine-tuning these dots and could also transport then the spin. But then the big question was, is it possible to do this then with only a few voltages? And the answer was no, it's not possible. And on the other hand, with our devices, we could do this transport with only a few voltages. And therefore, this conveyor belt method is the better one and is now also implemented by other groups. And maybe you heard there's even a conference that is the International Conference on Spin Shuttling that first took place in Aachen, was now in Los Angeles. This next year it should be in South Korea. So people really picked this up, this method, and it's now a complete change in architecture and gives many, many more possibilities, even beyond just transporting. One can find new manipulation schemes now when the qubits can be shuttled in this way.
When transporting a qubit across a silicon device, what factors begin to dominate its behavior?
So when you start transporting a qubit across a device via shuttling, some things that are more important now is a material parameter that's called valley splitting. You can imagine it basically as two additional states to your spin subspace that behave pretty much very, very similar to the spin subspace, just a tad bit different in other categories. So the main difference between these two sets of states is that the excited valley spin states have a slightly different G factor. And one thing that can happen if you shuttle around an area where the valley splitting gets rather small, so the two sets of states align pretty much in energy space, is you can get a hop into the other two states. And if this happens, what will happen to the qubit is it'll experience this slightly different G factor of the other valley. And if the hop is probabilistic and not deterministic, what might happen is you get a probabilistic phase that your qubit sees via this slightly changed G factor. And that could lead to decoherence. That's the first effect that can happen, or like the main thing that we at the moment are worrying about, and which is why we are analyzing material now more and more using the methods that we develop. And the other thing that could happen is if your Zeeman splitting aligns with your, so the spin splitting aligns with your valley splitting, and you are in a superposition or in the excited state, like the spin up state, you get an additional decoherence channel. So basically via this valley, your spin can relax quite a lot faster. So these are the two factors that begin to dominate its behavior. One thing that is actually advantageous when moving spins around or having mobile spin qubits is you have to worry a bit less about nuclear spins, because you get an effect called motional narrowing, where if your wave function sees more and more spins, or basically the overlap of the wave function of your electron with your alloy integrates over more and more nuclear spins, or more configurations of nuclear spins, let's say, it affects the coherence less.
So you said that the coherence is affected mainly because of the disorder in the system, right? And what are you then doing to address this?
The main thing what we are worrying about is the fact that these material parameters can change and do change across the alloy. And that is, as you say, due to alloy disorder, because in your silicon germanium barrier, you have 70% silicon, 30% germanium, and they are ordered not in a specified manner, but they can be ordered in a random way. And then depending on what your overlap with your barrier is, and the two valley states do have a quite different overlap, because they belong to quite opposing K vectors, and so they are they oscillate pretty much out of phase. What happens is material parameters, or like the energy scales of the valley splitting, they do vary quite a lot across the whole wafer. And what we are trying to do about this is there's some approaches at the moment that are being grown and fabricated, some ideas of how to design a wafer specifically to mitigate this issue. For instance, something called a wiggle well, where you don't just fabricate or don't just grow a quantum well, but you actually include some germanium atoms into the quantum well in an oscillating manner that aligns with the oscillations of your Bloch wave. And if you do that, that is proposed to enhance the valley splitting. This is something that has been now researched quite heavily in growth, and growth has been, like, I think there has been a recent publication from a collaborator of us, IKZ. And we now have these devices in our labs, and we want to measure them as quickly as possible and see where that takes us.
So essentially looking for ways to enhance the valley splitting so that these the ground states don't escape into the excited states.
Maybe I can add to this. The wiggle well is one approach. We also have from other collaborators, for example, TU Delft, you get devices where they think they already solved this by a better heterostructure. They also have on these heterostructures very exciting results on shuttling. But now the interesting is that really now a solved valley splitting problem, or do we do not understand the theory completely? We also have other projects with collaborators where we, for example, to put strain on the devices that can also help to split the valley splittings. There we have stressors. One of my PhD students, not here, Lucas Markoglis, is doing membrane devices and tries to put some strain in these devices. And then we also want to evaluate the valley splitting, because what is now really nice is that this transport method is not only good for transporting electrons from one side to the other, it's also a perfect method now to map properties of the heterostructure. For example, the valley splitting or charge disorder.
So experimentally, how are you mapping the valley splitting across the entire terrain that you're considering?
For this, what we are doing is we are basically shuttling a spin coherently, firstly, we initialize a spin singlet, a bell pair of two spins. We leave one static, and the other one we shuttle as fast as we can to a spot inside the channel. So we have this Cubus-type device design that Lars already had mentioned. And with that, we move it to a distance D. And there we then let it precess and basically interact with the material parameters that we are interested in, like the valley splitting, or what you can also measure is the G factor. For both, we do have slightly different pulses. For the valley splitting, what we do is we wait for a constant time, and then we shuttle the electron back and recombine and see whether we get a spin singlet or a spin triplet via Pauli spin blockade. And actually what we are interested about when we measure the valley splitting is not really whether it's a spin singlet or a spin triplet, but rather that there is still entanglement. And how we probe that is we measure this once, and then we sweep the magnetic field. And what we see is in the vicinity of the Valley splitting, so when the Valley splitting aligns with the Zeeman splitting, the phase is, like, we don't see a phase anymore. Basically, the state population drops to a 50% between spin singlet and spin triplet because it becomes a mixed state. And now, when we do this for one distance, it's not yet super clear where the Valley splitting is. But if we do this now for an entire patch inside our channel, what we get is we get a coherent background of some phases that vary due to local G factors and wait times that we leave the spin to precess in. So we have this coherent background, and within this coherent background, we have, with quite high contrast, a thin line of 50%, where it shouldn't actually be by background considerations. And when we correlate both the magnetic field and the distance, it becomes quite clear to sketch out this trace of valley splitting. And this way, we can record a one-dimensional trace of valley splitting, something that so far I think only has been done over a couple of nanometers, 20 nanometers-ish. We have now been able to do over a distance of 400 nanometers. And in principle, there's not that much stopping us from going further rather than just getting a device that can shuttle further coherently. So having this done now for one dimension, we actually have shuttling devices, we have additional gates with which we can shift the position of this one-dimensional electron channel, so this Q-bus channel where we move the electron along, not just in the distance coordinate, but also laterally in the Y-coordinate. We can basically displace the channel up and down. If you think about shuttling horizontally, you can move it vertically. And then you just repeat, rinse and repeat the measurement until you get a full two-dimensional map of your entire canvas where you can shuttle your electron. And this then can be used to record a valley splitting map. And actually, pretty similarly, we can also record the G factor. There we, instead of varying the magnetic field, what we do is we vary the wait time and then record the oscillations that result from this wait time variation. And these variations at the local spot, from the frequency of these, we can extract the G-factor difference or the G-factor relative to our static electron of the spin singlet. These two material parameters already give us quite a good insight into what's happening in our wafer. Now... In the future, I think we aim to look at all these improved heat structures that Lars and I have been talking about with exactly these methods and see what emerges as the best pathway.
And these measurements, you conduct them only at the end of a shuttle cycle, right?
Basically, we measure the spin state only at the end of the full shuttling experiment. So we initialize, and then we shuttle into the channel. Let it evolve there. This is where when it's in the channel, this is the important part where the actual physics happen, or like the physics we are interested in happen. Physics happen all the time. We shuttle back, and when we shuttle back, we have put it into a double quantum dot, and in this double quantum dot, we can make use of the Pauli spin blockade, where the spin triplet is blocked from tunneling, the singlet is not. If you tune your system, if you fine tune it to the right regime, at least that works. And then via this spin selective tunneling, one could say you are able to measure the spin state. So the measurement actually only happens really at the end, as you say.
And then you get the G factor directly from the valley splitting?
No. So the valley splitting and the G factor, they are different. The pulse is slightly different. They are different experiments.
Okay.
You basically, for the valley splitting, you have a constant wait time, and for the G factor, you have a varying wait time. And for the value splitting, instead of varying your wait time, you vary your magnetic field. Mm-hmm. Those are just two different parameters. And then from this, you can reconstruct these parameters.
So when you do the shuttling, so your electron literally moves. So could you define something like velocity or speed to these electrons?
Yes. There's actually quite some theory behind it, because these I've earlier spoken about these excitations to the higher energy valley state. They happen depending on the velocity with which you shuttle. So it's called a Landau-Zener transition. They did the theory on this quite a while ago already. And it's basically when you approach an anti-crossing, when your energy splitting between two states gets small and they are coupled with some sort of tunnel coupling, then depending on the variation or like the energy variation in principle, your excitation probability changes. And in recent times, we have thought about what would be an optimal shuttling speed to both be fast enough so that the spin does not decohere during shuttling, but also not too fast for us to get a lot of excitations. And that seems to be around 10 meters per second. These shuttling speeds have been achieved and basically also far beyond that is in principle possible electrostatically. Olas, do you agree? Is that an accurate representation?
That's very accurate. So the point of all this shuttling is that we move the electron in this quantum dot. And there it is nicely preserved and confined. And we also have to take care that the speed of this, the speed has to be sufficiently large that the clock rate of the quantum computer in the end is not slowed down by the shuttling. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a nice coincidence that this around 10 meters per second, sometimes also 50, 40 meters per second, are working quite well and are good for the clock speed, are sufficient in the speed. And so there were also now impressive results by other groups that it works with this velocity. But the problem at the moment is that it is still that most people shuttle forth and back a couple of times and then accumulate the distance, not shuttling over a large distance in one way. So we did this with charge in a device which is 10 micrometers in length. But what you can see is that then you find some crystal defects that come into the way, misfit dislocations, maybe other effects, maybe simple effects that the gates are not working or some other things in the setup is not working. So what we see now is what happens when we scale up. This is now what we see, because we have the largest devices in the community. And we see what's happening. And it's not only about valley. It's also that we have misfit dislocations that make the electrons stop moving, that there's a too large barrier. And these are now things that we have to take care of. And it's, again, back something that need to be optimized in the material.
So you also partly touched upon what was going to be my next question. And that is, you said that there's already a sort of limit on shuttling speeds. So does that also create a limit on the distance at which you can shuttle? Because I think in the bigger picture, you need to really take into account the shuttling times and then the gate times in order to then do something useful out of the computation.
So at the moment, you have to take all the operations into account. And the slowest operation beside shuttling is the readout. This is probably at the moment the weakest spot of the spin qubits, of all the platforms. And what we try is with the shuttling to be well faster than the readout. And the readout has to be not done at the very end of an operation, because we want to do quantum error correction. Readouts have to be done a couple of times within your algorithm, within your circuit. And at the moment, one can see that when we take this at the limit, we can shuttle quite far, sufficient for this still for this idea to implement cryo-electronics, so to go from one tile to the next and maybe even go beyond. What is in the way is not only to shuttle the spin, but also make sure that the charge can follow, and then these kind of new things, misfit dislocation and so on. We start to see that, and the perfection of the device, so all the gates have to work. And there we get at the limit of our academic devices, and we have now since a couple of years established an industry route of devices. And we also measure these, and hopefully they are more reliable than in the end.
Could you give us some time scales? You know, like the T1 times, T2 start times, and overall the gate times and shuttling times that you typically have.
Yeah, so the T2 start time in isotopically purified silicon, you can get, I think, up to 50 microseconds. Unfortunately, sometimes it's a bit shorter, around 10 microseconds, so even less. T1 time, I actually don't know. It's much, much longer. I don't know, Lars, whether you have the number, the T1 time.
So it depends much on spin-orbit interaction. In the silicon, we don't have much spin-orbit interaction there. It's a second, depends also on the size of magnetic field. It's so long that we do not really care about that anymore. But of course, if one simulates the depolarization channel versus the dephasing channel, I mean, it plays a crucial role, and it is something that we can benefit from in the future, that the T1 time is super long compared to T2.
And maybe regarding the shuttling distance that's possible, I think in the recent Delft coherent shuttling paper, there was an interesting calculation. The fastest shuttling speed that they got, they can shuttle more than 2 millimeters, which is obviously a significant fraction of the chip and probably more than you would require. If you think about, you have a two-dimensional grid, maybe the T-junction, but then you could implement the surface code unit cells that you need, the logical qubits, and obviously much less footprint than these millimeters.
Right. It's basically already at the size of a chip that we have in the end. So it's pointless to go beyond something like 20 millimeters because this will be the chip size. So that looks very, very promising.
Max, you already mentioned the T-junction. So coming to that, I think when you have multiple shuttled regions, especially regions where these shuttling lanes are perpendicular to each other, then you would think of something like the T-junction. So, and this is also what you've been working on. Can you tell us more about the T-junction? Where they are used, why they are used?
Yeah, so in principle, they are kind of the natural extension. If you have a linear shuttler, just our standard Cubus conveyor mode shuttle, you can obviously populate them with qubits, you can move them around, but you won't get one qubit to jump over the other. It's not really possible. You could do some gate-based swap with some error rate, and then you can compute in a linear chain, but obviously our chip is two-dimensional, and it would be very nice for us to also extend the architecture in that sense. Also, you know, if you have a two-dimensional architecture that naturally implements the topology, for example, for a surface code like quantum error correction scheme. And this is exactly where this T-junction comes in. So if you have, for example, two conveyors that might be independent of each other, you can join them at a 90-degree angle. And I did exactly this in my device, in my recent device. I stopped measuring now, I'm writing on the publication. There I have a 10 micrometer long Cubus, and then in the very center I put another 5 micrometer long Cubus perpendicular to that, and they're actually joined. So it is possible for electrons, I for my experiment only shuttled the charge because this device is so large and it's so difficult technologically, there it's possible to route then this electron charge that you might initialize in the horizontal shuttle lane into the vertical shuttle lane. And obviously there are some difficulties with that. You have quite dense gating in the center of such a device, which we are able to fabricate even academically, because we have very good technicians at HNF Nano Facility in Research Center Jülich. They have a very good e-beam, or actually two e-beam setups, so electron beam lithography setups, and that allows us to essentially bring these perpendicular shuttle lanes, the gates in those lanes, up to a distance, down to a distance of about 20 nanometers only. which is then sufficient, yeah, as Lars said, the quantum dots, the electrons, the electron wave function in the end is about 30 nanometers, 40 nanometers in size. And then if you get these gates close enough, you can just coax the electron to go from the horizontal to the vertical shuttling. And that works quite well.
Does this affect the spin of the electron when you're sort of changing its direction of shuttling?
So in my experiment, I only shuttled the charge. The change in shuttling direction, that sounds a bit like you have the electron, you shoot it down a linear direction, and then you have to apply a force, Newton and so, in order to steer the electron around. This is, I think, a common misconception that people get about the shuttling. So it is essentially, from a perspective of the kinetics of the electron, what's going on, it's essentially a stationary process. Yeah, we are shuttling with a few millimeters per second, but the kinetic energy of the electron is basically negligible in this sense. So it's not like you have to steer the electron. It's essentially just you give a, you impose a confinement potential that you deform with your gates, and then the T-junction, you have these two conveyors, the potential, the confinement potential, the quantum dots that they form, they merge, and then you break them apart again such that the electron follows the direction that you want to. But the electron just follows the potential minimum if it has enough space for the wave function to not to be well confined, and that it doesn't break up because you have, for example, potential minima next to each other with a barrier in between. But if you ensure that the potential is well defined, the electron just follows that.
And actually, these experiments, maybe you wonder why we care about electrons alone and not about the spin. There's always two stages of these experiments, and they are both very challenging. Just moving the electron sounds maybe easy and not very great to work with from the theory side, but it is already a big challenge because of this restriction that we give ourselves, that we only use very few signals to control that. And in fact, in this experiment that Max did, we had more than 50 quantum dots involved, and the filling of all these quantum dots were controlled by just 8 signals. And this is quite remarkable, and we could set different patterns, move them around. One can even think of classical computing with these electrons as a digital unit, and the storage works also remarkably well. They do not escape us, it gives completely new ways of thinking that when you have these kind of shuttling, and we have even some collaboration with people that try to use shuttling to define a new way for the current, for defining ampere, so a metrology project.
But is there any use if you can't maintain the spin coherence and just move the electrons?
Well, so in principle, so that's what I wanted to say. So if you can move the charge, in principle, this linear shuttling and this junction shuttling shouldn't be too different from each other. And we know that we can shuttle coherently in a linear shuttling. Of course, you have some details in there. The confinement of the wave function changes a bit. The quantum dot, the wave function changes the shape. And that will probably have some amount of influence. But in principle, we know that from the coherent linear shuttling, you apply a proper confinement voltage. The drive amplitude needs to be sufficiently large. In that sense, we would expect that we get the spin around the corner. So, in principle, nothing goes against it. That obviously has to be demonstrated. My focus was more on this very large device, as Lars said, 54 quantum dots into these two shuttle lanes. So you have quite large distances involved where shuttling through coherently still remains a bit of a challenge. But in principle, it should be possible.
Yeah, and maybe to add to this, so there's also some projects with PTB on standardizing the, like, yeah, basically current, right? Maybe Lars can actually tell that story a little better. But that also is just relying on the electron being shuttled and not necessarily the spin. And I think the shuttler is a strong contender there. Trying to get that to a good standard.
Indeed. What were the challenges that you faced in realizing these T-junctions? And did you have any unexpected results or surprises in your observation?
Yeah, so the one challenge I already stated, that's difficulty to fabricate this from a gate distance perspective. But that, again, we have quite well under control, 20 nanometers. But still, this device, it's 10 micrometers by 5 micrometers, has over 200 individual gates. By their principle connected together in these combs, in these clavature gates, such that you only have to apply two voltages to 4 gates per shuttle lane, so total 8. All of these fingers on these combs still have to be fabricated. And for that, you really need to have your process quite well under control. These are tiny nanostructures. They are about 60 nanometers in width. They are only 15, maybe 40 nanometers in height. And they are about, what is it, roughly? I think it's about 1 micrometer long in the end, the finger itself, maybe a bit shorter. But so this has to be fabricated. The samples need to be screened. I fabricated them in this case also myself, so you have to be quite careful there. You have to check every step. Don't check them too much. There are some concerns regarding SEM, electron bombardment, because that might degrade the heterostructure interfaces. But but once you have that all of that under control, I could fabricate the sample. And then, in principle, the measurement itself, once you have the setup up and running, is quite simple conceptually, but obviously you have these details. You have to be sure that your shuttling actually works linearly. So I can't just immediately verify this junction transfer where I go around the corner. I first have to verify that I even get there. Tuning this in the beginning, you have not much of an idea what these voltages are that you have to apply. You're unsure what failed now. Did the linear shuttling fail? Did this transfer fail? Did the transfer back fail only and not the transfer into the other shuttling, but only back? All of these problems have to be calibrated, have to be figured out, and then carefully analyzed. But once you have that working, as Lars said, you have these 8 pulses that you can apply, and that controls your entire device. And if they are once calibrated, typically they stay quite consistent, even through cool down thermal cycles. So if you warm the sample up, it's measured in a dilution refrigerator, you cool it back down. We're actually surprised how stable this was. And then if you're doing the experiment, there are a few more things that I found quite interesting. For example, we observed that you can easily shuttle more than one electron in a quantum dot. These drive amplitudes that you apply can be quite strong, even within the limited thermal budget that you might have. And in that case, you can stack multiple electrons in the same quantum dot and perfectly fine shuttle them linearly around the corner and so on. And you can even, and I tried that, I don't have systematic data on this, but I tried this by playing around at the end of my measurement. You can even load these electrons into the separate arms where you have independent control, move them towards the center and then stack them there. So something like this is quite interesting. I guess this probably won't work coherently with the electron spin. Maybe we are surprised there. But with the charges, you can play around a lot. And I think the final aspect that was interesting for me from the T-junction is that this allows you to do essentially, I alluded to that earlier, the swap gate by just swapping electrons. So normally, if you have a linear chain, it's quite difficult to do a swap. You have to do these actual quantum gates in order to transfer the quantum state, swap the quantum states of these two qubits. And this is error-prone in principle, while this T-junction swapping, you just take 2 electrons, shuttle one ahead and one following, shuttle to the junction, go up with the one, go straight with the other, and then swap them around. This works quite well. Obviously, I didn't test it for spin, but from the charge perspective, it worked as well as the shuttling does, and it works very, very well, much, much better. Than what we would expect be. So we wouldn't expect that the charge shuttling is the limiting factor for the spin shuttling. And you can see that then. You get this swap operation essentially for free.
Could you also imagine doing other 2-qubit gate operations in these shuttling channels, as you already mentioned that you could have multiple electrons coming together?
Yes, certainly. So for that, the T-junction is obviously not really required. But if you have a linear shuttle device and, for example, you have a small magnet on the side, which you might use for other aspects, for 2-qubit gates, you could also then, when you shuttle away from that, the qubit, the electron sees a magnetic field gradient that is changing. And then depending on how fast you shuttle through that, you can cause essentially rotations on the Bloch sphere, and that's effectively a single qubit gate. And I think this has been now demonstrated. I don't know whether this is published by now, this has been demonstrated in a device. And so this is definitely possible.
Yeah, at the moment, the fantasy is triggered by this shuttling, and one can have completely new schemes. Usually one tries to avoid to have too many qubits together because it's difficult to control them. So one big point, big plus of this shuttling approach is that that only two qubits meet each other in a manipulation zone and all the other qubits are far away, so that some crosstalk can be avoided.
Yes.
So, you know, now that we have discussed so many fascinating results from your experiments, what's really interesting about your research is that all the results that you have got is not just sitting in the lab, but then you have taken these insights and dead into the creation of a startup called Arc Systems. So, Lars, can you tell me what actually motivated you and your co-founders to turn these academic research results into a startup?
So first of all, there are a couple of startups in the quantum technology, quantum computing business. But of course, there are some requirements. And one thing is that we have this idea, a vision, how we want to have millions of qubits working together. It's all around this shuttling approach. And we filed 20 patents. That is also a good base for a startup. And now we can try to realize this vision. And there's one definite problem in this is that we have still kind of small demonstrators. We can operate 50 electrons, but what we aim at is millions. And what we then need is a high degree of professionality in many ways, software, fabrication. So we look at what stage we have to transition from our academic devices to industry devices. And this is already what we are doing in projects. We have collaborations, strong collaborations with Infineon, and there are some other Leibniz Institutes, Fraunhofer Institutes involved. It's a great opportunity in Germany that we have these many institutes, and when they are working together, we can do really something remarkable. And now we have to also bring this other things together. One thing, for example, is that now when we want to reach that, one has to do mass characterization, a high degree of professionality in all the steps. I can give you a little example of where we see at the moment limitations. For example, we found out that now increase the number of qubits and the number of wiring. We have to take more and more care about the setups, reliability of bonding wires. The PCBs are getting more and more complex, smaller capacitors and resistors on it that is more and more difficult to handle. And this all has to be professionalized, and one has to have specific groups that working hand in hand and fabricate these devices. And it's still working also quite well in conjunction with the with academic projects. For example, we have now a master thesis, very simple, on bonding. And we communicate with our institutes here in Aachen who are working on modules for the Large Hadron Collider. And there they have a very good experience in this high degree of reliability that you need for such a project. And this is now, this all has to now get together, and all these groups have to work together.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen a lot of spin-offs from academic institutions, like researchers becoming entrepreneurs, especially in the quantum industry. Mm-hmm. Do you think it helps to come from an academic background as a founder? And how do the founders' expertise and roles complement with one another?
So I'm a CTO together with Hendrik Blum. He's also CTO. It definitely helps that we have this scientific background. It gives us deep knowledge. But I think it's not sufficient for a startup company. So we are also very happy that we have co-founders who have a very different background. The other co-founder is Dr. Markus Beckers. He's engineer side. He's a very agile networker, knows the patent business very well, worked as a patent engineer. And there's also Dr. Wolfgang Meissner, and he has a large experience and background in large projects that work with billions of dollars, fusion reactors. He also was at McKinsey as a consultant, so he has this background of how the economic part of such a startup works, and these are very essential to do such a project. And it's really a complicated endeavor, and it depends on many, many factors. So I think with these co-founders, and you ask about them, their background, we have a good start, we have the patents. And what we now also need are good employees, students. And in the end, we hope that the excellent students that we have at RWTH Aachen and in our group, that they like to stay in the company, and that we can attract very good employees from other companies. At the moment, the status was in the last years that we had kind of a brain drain to other companies. We had a couple of students working now at Intel, Microsoft, and so on. And these are very, very attractive positions, and we hope that with Arc Systems we can also give some opportunities for the students here in Aachen.
Also, did you feel personally you need to change your way of thinking in order to meet the industry requirements, like the way you approached research or the way you planned? So did you feel that you had to change your way because in order to meet the startup culture or the industry requirements?
Yeah, there is some different way of thinking. This is something that we implemented already in the past in the institute. One has to do a much stricter project management, and these specialized groups working together has also a couple of consequences. I can here give one example. On our academic side, Max Beer fabricated these T-junctions on his own. He pre-characterized them, tested them, did some simulations, put them into a fridge, repaired the fridge, and measured the device, and then it worked in the end. And it's a really fascinating result. And then also a big effort, because he covered all this production chain. It took a couple of years, but this is possible. But now when you want to professionalize that, then you have kind of special groups working together. And what we now witnessed within this year is that there are now some interface weaknesses. So when you give the sample to somebody else, or first fabricate the device, and then you give it to somebody else, and who has to bond them, and then to test them, and we need to have very good workflows to always qualify whether the previous step was working. And this is something that I have learned during my studies, and now it's the hard way of working, and we cannot do just trial and error anymore. So we have some, from academia, we have some thinking of, oh, this works, probably it will also work the next time. And now we have to qualify some things and really check how high is the yield. Is the yield sufficient? So for example, for bonding, we tested some bonding with 200 bonds. That gives us a certain yield when everything works, but is that really sufficient? If you want to have a large device that consists of 1,000 bond wires, you have to have a much larger sample size, of course, and these kind of things now enter. And we have to make protocols to check all these steps. So we have to work on these workflows. And that also involves now some kind of different thinking.
Kudos to Max.
That's actually then where it comes from, that I know that the sample is stable across thermal cycles. I had quite a few of those. It happens if you fix your own fridge. So,
So now that lot of experiments happen at your research labs. How do you decide which all these experiments will meet the industry related requirements, and how do you shift it from your research lab to your startup company?
So what I think is a change is that in academia, for a paper, it's sometimes sufficient to have one star chip that works, that operates. And in a similar way, then also the benchmarking is done. So we have, of course, certain benchmark schemes that are common among quantum computing, how to measure the fidelity of a single gate, a two-qubit gate, and so on and so on and so on. And this is also something that transfers to the company. But then probably what is no different is that this has to be done continuously. So it's not only one lucky shot by a PhD student within his project. It has to be done all the time reliably. For that, one needs to have the software. One needs to have equipment for mass characterization. We get from the industry wafers of chips, and there on such a wafer there are several hundreds, thousand chips, and we have to characterize them, also to give feedback to the industry, which of their fabrication steps worked and which have not worked. So this is completely different than fabricating 10 devices in a clean room in academia. And for that reason, we also have, within the company, we make now our own equipment. We have, for example, a device that is called MPACT, that is for a cryostat with electronics that we can use for mass characterization. It's also something that we sell to other companies. And this is generally something that I think is good, that these companies, a lot of them come from academia and they work together in project. They also still have some useful exchange now on this startup side. But in the end, we still need this common effort to bring quantum computing forward, specifically for semiconductors, because it's this fabrication is also complex.
Yeah, before we move into the end, I just want to ask you, for the listeners, if you have open positions at your startup and in your group, you can let them know.
Yes, we have now a couple of new projects. Yes, I think this is now confirmed, and therefore we have many open positions. And these concern many different fields. We need a good programmer. There are possibilities, opportunities for theory, but we also need technicians working, for example, on bonding, testing devices. We have here an open position at the moment in Jülich. There will be also more position announced for ARC soon. So this is the reason for this is because we just got a lot of projects. And so it's definitely worth to check our web pages for ARC, also the LTVR, which opportunities we have. And as I said, it covers a lot of different topics, electro engineers, technicians, theory and experiments, programming. It's a joint effort.
Also, like in the near term, what are the technological milestones are you aiming from ARC Systems' point of view?
Mm-hmm. In ARC Systems, we're at the moment tuning up a 5-qubit chip that is set up in Jülich. So this is the first we aim at selling quantum computers. So this the first quantum computer will have 5 qubits in silicon, and it has implemented our shuttle technique. Then our next project will be around a 200-qubit chip. And that is then the stage. So this is probably then also a chip that comes from industry. And then we have at some point the transition step. We aim at that around 3 years in the future, where we have to implement seriously the cryoelectronics. There are some first steps where we have a cryoelectronic chip next to our quantum chip, but they have to be packaged together to really make this tile-up structure. And I think then will be the time when we have the scale-up boost, when we can bring them together, have high yield from the industry chips, can bring them together with cryochips, manage, have a thermal management, when this works, we will see where are the limits and to what extent we now can then scale up.
Also, like, are there any technical breakthroughs you hope to achieve so that you can significantly scale these qubits?
So the main technical breakthroughs that we need is first to get this last stopping point for shuttling out of the way. This is the valley splitting, and we put at the moment a lot of effort into that from all different kind of perspectives. We try to approach that. There's one way of improving the material, but there are plan A, B, and C. There's also a plan to just invest more into complexity of the signals and get around the points, so do a kind of a slalom shuttle. When we know this 2D map, as Mats described it, we can also do these kind of things. There is also a plan maybe to go to another material system that doesn't have this valley issue, but then maybe other issues. Germanium, silicon germanium is a candidate, but that suffers a lot from large spin orbit interaction. So this is one side, and the other side, which is I think the big challenge, is to implement the cryoelectronics. And there one needs to have not just cryoelectronics working, but it has to be on a small footprint, and the thermal management when we bring together the cryoelectronics and the quantum chip. We are not allowed to heat up the quantum chip that much. The core quantum chip or quantum layer is more robust than superconducting qubits. So the next big challenge is really to have the cryogenics working. And for that, we need them not just working as a side chip, but what we need is to have the right footprint of the electronics. We need to have the thermal management when everything is packaged together. And this will be quite exciting. And this is not the core knowledge of the physicists. It also involves circuit designers, electro engineers, and it's also a big cooperation effort.
Thank you, Lars, for your insights. So before we wrap up today, I'd love to hear some personal reflections. So looking back, what have been the most important lessons you've learned in translating academic research into a functioning startup?
Oh, that's a very good question. First of all, it is really an endeavor, and it looks like a big challenge, and one needs what I said, this high degree of professionality, talking to investors in different ways than talking to physicists. This is definitely one way, but it's similar to what researchers are always doing. We have a high level of robustness against frustration. It's maybe a continuation of all the frustration that we had also while we tried to get into this shuttle. So as an example, I told you we had this Quantera project for the shuttling in 2017, and then fortunately ML4Q also supporting that, and that was the point where that really starts running. Before that, I had two proposals that didn't work and that also had the shuttling in it, and that was Eminöta and Sonderforschungsbereich. And these kind of things then also continue when you go to a company. And these issues need to be solved.
And also for other researchers who are listening, who might be considering launching a spin-off company from their work, what advice would you give them?
I think you need a good team. It's not sufficient to have just knowledge about the technology. You need to also know about the economic part of a startup. One has to be brave to start with this. It's also a time invest. And one can try. Maybe one can also see in Germany, people are hesitant with new technologies, and other companies like US seems to be easier. But well, in the end, one needs to try.
Okay, so with that, I think we come to an end. Thank you, Lars, Mats, and Max, for sharing your insights, experience, and the exciting work you are doing. This topic was particularly very, very interesting for me, as I've already worked in it. And it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast, and I'm sure our listeners have gained a lot from hearing about spin qubits, the science, and the story also behind ARC systems.
Yeah, thank you very much for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.